Welcome to another episode of Photo Geek Weekly. This is episode 47, and we're recording it on November 23rd, 2018. Joined with me today to talk about all the geekiest photo stuff that we could drum out of a week that had absolutely no interesting news is somebody I hope this man can help make things a little bit interesting, possibly a little humorous as well through the conversation. He's got a skill that actually makes me look competent in front of the camera as well, which I greatly admire. I have Jordan Drake with me today. Jordan, how are you?
I'm doing great. Really excited to be here.
Perfect. What I was referring to, of course, is we did an episode of DP Review TV, which you do all of the video work and the, I'm assuming, quite boring post work on that stuff to bring a very succinct and useful and often entertaining little bit of knowledge, whether it be a camera review or we were talking about macro photography techniques within that. And I think you did a great job putting all that together.
Yeah, we really like doing kind of the educational. It's kind of a nice change of pace. And it was fun because when Chris is actually talking to somebody that he's really interested in learning from them, then it's a lot easier for me to cut the episode because he's actually asking the questions that a person who's interested would ask, as opposed to having to be prompted or anything like that. I was really happy with how that episode turned out and people seem to be loving it. So thanks for doing that.
You use pretty much everything, including the rather juvenile cold open that I'm so glad was able to be in there.
People love that cold open.
And I, you know, it's funny because I've been on a number of fairly popular YouTube shows. Tony and Chelsea Northrup have had me on their show a number of times. And it's always scary to go to the YouTube comment section because that's often where the vitriolic demons of the internet like to have fun.
Yeah.
But I've been pleasantly surprised at some of the feedback. So if you haven't seen that episode, it's about 12 minutes long. I encourage you to do so. And I'll put the link to that in the show notes as well. But Jordan, tell people that might not be familiar about you, because you're not in front of the camera very often, right. But your voice, I certainly respect. What do you do for a day job?
Well, now DP Review, producing their YouTube channel, is my primary gig. I'm also a freelance cinematographer, editor, basically anything on a production level. I'm happy to give a hand on any crew positions. Before that, I spent a decade working at the Camera Store in Calgary. Built their video department, and Chris and I started their YouTube channel there about 9 years ago. So we've been doing the YouTube thing for quite a while now.
And you've got quite a following. I know the video that we did is at 110,000 views or something, and you're at 130-something thousand subscribers or followers.
Yeah, it's been kind of an interesting change because we did take a big subscriber hit, and that's something that we'll definitely talk about with one of the news stories here today that rolls right into it. But yeah, it's been growing really well. I mean, we're thrilled with it, kind of doubling up the subscribers in just a couple months.
Yeah, and you look at how these kind of networks kind of grow organically. You're building a community, effectively, and you'll find similar faces, in the comment section, and possibly emailing you as well, and interacting with you and all the content that you create. I'm just curious, on a personal level, how much of that community involvement and interactive feedback do you use to create your content moving forward? Like, is it something that influences what you create?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Like, we look at everything, both Chris and I, and you do start to see a few things that just recur all the time. And that's typically what we prioritize for, like doing the educational content. Yours is actually by far the most successful that we've ever done, was that macro video.
But let's just put it into perspective here, because when you do a camera review of a flagship camera from any manufacturer, that is far and above, like it's like into orbit, in terms of the views and in terms of the interaction, because a lot of times people will reload the video to see what new comments have been, placed in response to theirs, because people get into the brand loyalty wars quite easily on YouTube.
Yeah, exactly. Everybody wants to throw their opinion, not just on the video, but on the camera. So that does tend to lead to a whole lot more engagement. But going back to what people are talking about in terms of looking at the feedback and things like that, we always see, like, you know, for the people who watched it, they want more of that educational stuff, or, you know, something a little more off the beaten path, which we really love doing, like the Laowa probe lens or something interesting.
I'm still waiting for mine to get here. I've got some really fun ideas to use that lens with this wintertime. One of them, like, could you imagine this, Jordan? If I could have a freezing soap bubble, which is something I do a lot of. You might have seen the image that I posted up earlier today.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
I have some experiments with that. But what if I have on video a soap bubble that's in the process of just freezing solid, and then the focus pulls forward to a snowflake that's rotating into position and sparkling at scale? Because that lens is capable of doing that, and very few lenses are. And so I've got a bunch of cinematic ideas and concepts that will probably end up in a documentary at some point, as those ideas have done previously. But that lens, and I saw your review of it, you made it fun, but it also got the gears spinning inside my head to say, okay, how can I take this knowledge and use it on my own and push forward with my own creativity?
Well, that one was really difficult because we got the lens. You know, it had been rumored and we'd seen prototypes and stuff like that for years, but we got the lens before the official launch of it. So, you know, we were just noodling around doing our usual wide angle portrait stuff or wide angle macro stuff with it. And it was when we were in Seattle and the actual lens was launched that we saw all these amazing examples of people physically moving the lens through something, which I think is where it's by far the most interesting. So we dropped a little bit into that video, but I really want to do a follow-up now that I know where that lens is most effective. I think that would be a lot of fun. And what you're talking about sounds like exactly what that lens excels at.
Yeah, well, it goes up to a 2-to-1 magnification, if I'm not mistaken. And if I'm shooting on a camera that has a cropped video mode, then 2-to-1 can be amplified quite significantly, and it would work for that one scenario that I provided. But when I sit down and try to shoot that, I'm going to meet with a ton of frustration and a ton of new ideas to go along with it. You know, that's the kind of stuff that it rattles around in my head. I wish I had a film crew just looking at me trying to figure this stuff out on the go, because that problem solving endeavor is really where the creative muscle is.
You know, what might be fun is just drop a time-lapse camera by you while you're noodling around with that and explain your thought process. That would be fascinating.
My GX9 is going to be a backup camera when I finally get my hands on a Panasonic S1R, which I'll be shooting a lot of this stuff on. And so it'll be just constantly rolling B-roll in the background. And who knows where that will be useful for. But anyhow, Jordan, let's get into the stories of the week, because there are some interesting ones here. And an interesting paradigm that I see kind of shaping the internet of the future, for better or for worse. Mm-hmm. The first story is now this is from the story that I linked to is from Photo Shelter, which is a kind of a competitor to Squarespace, which they're writing about here. But I don't think that impacts the concern that they are writing about. Their title is Squarespace is officially screwing photographers. Okay, that seems harsh, and rightly from a competitor standpoint, I'm sure that they want it to be.
Yes.
But this has to go back a little while to a service called Unsplash. Jordan, are you familiar with Unsplash?
Yeah, I've been aware of them for a little while now.
Okay, well, instead of me just doing all the descriptions, why don't you describe what Unsplash is doing or not doing for photographers?
Well, essentially what they're doing, it's just like any other photo upload website that a lot of people seem to be using as a portfolio. But then you're giving up the rights to those photos to be used in any kind of commercial or basically any application that you can come up with.
So anybody can go to Unsplash and take your work for any purpose that they want, and there's nothing that you can do to stop them.
Yeah. And they say, like, what does the photographer get out of this? And they're like, we advise people who use your photos to give you a credit, but it's optional. And that's how basic things are. And yeah, essentially the photographers don't get much out of the service.
And I remember them originally pitching it to a tone of, well, you know, you've got, you know, hundreds of thousands of photos that are collecting dust that you don't necessarily care that much about on your computer that you may have never edited, that might have never seen the light of day. Why don't you give them a second chance? Why don't you put these out here so that somebody else might benefit from your work that is somewhat secondary? Mm-hmm. And even at that point, I find it suspicious, because I, you know, my work is valuable. Not every image that I take is a success, but a lot of them are stepping stones towards that success. And they have some of the value that the finished piece that I publish will have. When I was shooting freezing soap bubbles yesterday, I ended up with over 100 images. I've published one. I might publish five. But that the other 95 images, I don't want them to be available for free if they're half as good or 60% of the ones that I would actually be licensing and selling. But if somebody thought, well, 60% is good enough for what we want, then I get no money out of that at all. Mm-hmm. So I think that this is definitely not in the favor of photographers. Now, enter Squarespace. So Squarespace, and I'm going to quote here. So they say, I guess, from a press release or from instructions on when you're setting up a Squarespace website, which for those that are unfamiliar is a template-based system where you choose a template that you like, and then you can customize it to the nines. You can rearrange everything. It's sort of a nice visual editor behind the scenes. So if you have no experience designing a website, then there's no barrier here. It's designed to be simple, but very powerful. So in this quote, it says, now, instead of putting extra time or money into creating your own visuals, now you can simply replace the demo content on your chosen template with ease. Unsplash has an active group of contributing photographers from all around the world who have generously decided to share their work with others in the broader creative community for free. So, I love
the wording of that. That's wonderful.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you're a brand, if you're a mom and pop shop, you know, you're selling kettle corn on the corner or whatever, but you want to create, those people don't need a Squarespace website. I don't know where I'm going with that. But if you are a small business that has a potential interest in building a website, but you don't want to go to even iStock Photo and those images, which are inexpensive. Micro stock is pretty cheap.
Yeah.
But now you don't even have to go that route. You don't have to pay the photographers pennies or peanuts. You can give them absolutely nothing. And I'm surprised it took this long for a major company to be found doing this. Maybe there are others that I'm unaware of within the photographic space, but they are directly adding this as a value to Squarespace customers, and the photographers supplying the images get absolutely nothing for it. And one can assume, based on the way that was worded, that there's no credit that's required. I mean, you're building them into a website template. There's not any space for a byline that's going to be attached to that, right?
Yeah, exactly. And what seems really weird to me with this is we've seen, and you mentioned Tony and Chelsea Northrup. I bet when you were doing their live show, there was a Squarespace ad in that. They've tried so hard to reach out to the photographer community.
And I think that they've done a good job of it.
Yeah. Most of the work that I get, people know me from the YouTube show or, just friends in the industry. But I've been really thinking, now that I'm freelancing, I should have a website together. So, just something quick I can throw together with a sizzle reel and, some basic templates and stuff. That'd been something rolling around in my head. And it's like, yeah, maybe I'll just grab a Squarespace or something. But I'm certainly going to think twice about it now.
Yeah, this seems like it's a slap in the face to all of the photographers that have ever, built a website on Squarespace. Sadly, though, if you already have a Squarespace website, this announcement, whatever, it's probably going to fly right past you because it's irrelevant to you. Your website has already been built. And if you're a photographer, of course, you're going to be putting your own images on the website and not somebody else's, let's hope, anyhow. So from that perspective, photographers, I'm glad that I'm aware of this and that we can talk about this, but I think that many photographers, even using Squarespace, are going to continue to be oblivious to this quote-unquote collaboration with Unsplash.
Yeah, I'm just surprised that it was Squarespace, but you're right. I'm sure someone else would have jumped on this. I think like Wix is probably their major competitor, the same kind of idea. Someone, if you're looking between two website building utilities and one of them is pre-set up with a bunch of templates for a bunch of free images, and like you said, you are a small business, you're going to lean in that direction. It does definitely put photographers in a rocky place when that's the most commonly used one, as far as I'm aware, for photographers to set up a portfolio page, things like that. And now the company seems to be running with a contrary interest.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. Will they correct this mistake? Well, they might not see it as a mistake. And I think that's part of the bigger issue where the value of a photographic content is so low that it's often assumed that if it's on the internet, it must be free. Now, I deal with copyright infringement on a regular basis with my work. I mean, there's a number of images that get infringed upon very regularly. I talk about it periodically on this exact podcast because people find it online and they are ignorant of copyright law, and ignorance is not a defense. And so I have lawyers that deal with that. But this is kind of flying in the face of that logic because they are literally saying, if it's on our website, it's free to use. And that public mentality, you know, for people that are trying to make a living or even just licensing their work at a very low cost, well, it's just not there. You know, I'll often reference Getty Images has a rights managed photo like calculator where you can plug in the industry, the audience, whether it's print or digital, et cetera. You fill in all the specifics. And it spits out a price at the end. And if you want to use any of Getty's rights managed images, that number is your starting point. And you'd be surprised how high those numbers usually are. Your work is probably worth more than you think, especially if you look at the microstock websites that I haven't used for ages. I mean, I might have mentioned it on this podcast, but I stopped using iStock Photo when I was looking at the referral list of my website and I saw the journal Nature on that list. Thinking, well, what the heck is the journal Nature linking to my website for? Well, they bought one of my snowflake photographs from iStock Photo. And they didn't have to. They had a license and they paid for it, but they gave a credit and they linked back to my website. And you know how much I got paid for that?
I'm going to say 45 cents.
It was between $1 and $2, but okay. I mean, it's not much better. And the funny part was I wanted to have a copy of that issue to frame and put on my wall. Hey, you know what? It was kind of screwed over here a little bit, but it is a cover shot. So, to buy a standalone issue of the journal Nature Structural and Molecular Biology cost something like $300. I wrote them an email and they graciously sent me one for free with their compliments. But this goes back to that argument about the value of an image, right? And I think that Unsplash is deteriorating that value for all the photographers out there. And now the big companies are, you know, embracing that. And it's sad. I don't know if there's much more to talk about than that, but it upsets me. And I will never use Unsplash. And unless Squarespace changes their mind, it's not going to be a service I'm going to recommend for photographers anymore.
Yeah, I just think it's one more step into that kind of continuous process we're seeing where people have the expectation that photography should be free. And it's just a shame to see that get legitimized more and more as these bigger companies jump on it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think that's all we can say about that one. But the next story I think is interesting for photographers that are trying to get a name for themselves out there. And, you know, I've been offered exposure, quote unquote, for my work. It happens all the time. People just
that's
want
what I offered
for
you.
Yeah, exactly. people want to use my work for free, and they say, "Oh, well, this will be a great opportunity for you." You know, it's a win-win scenario. No, it's not, because exposure is not really valuable to me when you should be paying me for my work. And the segue that I'm trying to make here is exposure comes in a lot of different ways, and perceived exposure, you know, a perceived audience can be of great value for a photographer potentially looking for sponsors or for advertisers for their images, their content that they create. And one, it's been a thorn in my side for a long time. And I've always seen, I get these spam emails all the time saying, oh, we'll give you followers on whatever social media platform that you like. And some of them even spell out, okay, you know, $50 will get you, you know, 5,000 followers, or, you know, $5,000 gets you a million. I'm thinking, okay, those numbers aren't real. I mean, these are robots, or these are non-English speaking people that own 20 accounts working for a firm in India. And those inflated numbers, however, can grab the attention of said advertisers and sponsors. If you have a million followers on Instagram, then you're going to get attention, even though the interactions that you receive might not be that meaningful from that number. And case in point, I was featured as a user on the featured or the suggested users list on Google Plus in its early days. And I got up to 1.3 million followers from that. And I mean, that's huge, but how many of those are actually robot accounts that just follow somebody and click some checkboxes on opening, or are non-English speaking people? My engagement from that number was far less than if I was on Facebook, where I currently have like 15,000. And, you know, I get, you know, dozens and dozens of comments on anything that I would put out. So the story is, Instagram is deleting fake followers and likes. You know, I got to play that like a hallelujah soundbite or something there. But
that's on you.
Yeah. But yeah. And it's interesting because they like, and you can see very specifically, they're showing notices for people that says, we are removing inauthentic likes and followers, followed by the text. It looks like you may have shared your username and password with an app offering followers or likes. we're removing activity like new followers from these apps to protect our community from inauthentic activity. Change your password and stop them from accessing your account. And I think that this is a slap on the wrist for anybody that has decided to use such a service. And I hope that they are legitimately finding them all and taking them to task. But at the same time, should the punishments be more severe, or would that just destroy their platform?
Yeah, and it's tough to say, because I initially, when I started seeing these things, it was like, whatever, it doesn't really affect me or anything like that. And you have to remember that, you know, my other big platforms, Twitter and YouTube, do this constantly. You can see your subscriber graph, and every once in a while, you'll get that burn day where you'll drop, you know, 100 followers or whatever. But this, I can understand some motivation behind people doing this, which I never could before, because we just went from, you know, 320,000 down to, you know, when we started DP Review, 50,000 subscribers on YouTube. And that's the first question that any marketing company or anything that you need access, weirdly enough, our views are the same as they were on the other channel, but everybody wants subscriber numbers. Same thing on Instagram. How many followers do you have? Same thing on Twitter. So I can certainly see why, if you wanted to immediately legitimize yourself, theoretically, it might make some sense to buy those, just buy a bunch of followers. But I love seeing purges like this, just to level that playing field out.
And it's not always what I like about it is it's not just a purge. It's like the dog pooped on the carpet and you're rubbing his nose in it. It's like, okay, we know you have done this. So not only are we going to remove them, we are going to tell you that we found out and we're going to tell you to stop. And if some people don't, I mean, maybe it could be detrimental that their account is suspended for a period of time, or maybe something more dramatic. And you're right, this does happen on other platforms. Instagram has been a hotbed of influencer activity, where you've got people that, you know, will, you know, take a picture of them putting on a particular pair of socks and mentioning what it is. And sometimes they're caught copying and pasting placeholder text that reveals that this is a sponsored post. And that is kind of the bane of Instagram, in my opinion. I'd never follow any of those people. But if you find something that you like and you see that person has, you know, a significant number of followers, it also legitimizes them to your legitimate follower base to grow it organically at a more rapid rate. I think that's not fighting the good fight. So I've never done it. I've promoted my posts on Instagram and Facebook, and I tried it once on Twitter. It wasn't terribly successful, which is where you pay the platform to have your own content appear as sponsored material to other people that might not be following you. And I do that regularly on some of these platforms. The last time I did that on Facebook, I did a campaign. I think it cost me about $100 and I got about 1,000 followers from it. That was a pretty good return. I mean, if I consider what my marketing budget is these days, that's it. Right.
Well, and I would love to see how those numbers line up compared to outright buying followers.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm sure I could find a firm out there that for $100 would give me a lot more than 1,000 followers, but that would not be the kind of engagement that I want. And you know, it's funny too, because sometimes I'll promote a post if I was traveling in a specific country. We were in Austria and Bulgaria earlier this year. And if I took an image in those countries, I'd promote it to the people in that country. And it's lovely how many responses I get in those foreign languages that are complimenting me on the work. And I can translate it. My wife speaks Bulgarian, of course, so we can write responses back in that language. So that kind of organic interaction, I think, is much, much more useful.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's completely legitimate. It doesn't do anything to devalue your brand. What I would kind of love to see them do, as opposed to suspending accounts and things like that, is just throw a little marker on accounts that have been red flagged. I think that would be, you know, we got a blue check mark, maybe do a little red X or something like that on it. I'm sure we'd just see a whole bunch of people starting new profiles immediately. But it would be, I think, a really great quick visual reference to say, hey, maybe not everything that you see here is as it seems.
That's a great idea. I hope that they embrace something towards that effect. And social media is really how I get my work out there. And I'm on about 5 or 6 different platforms. And, Twitter and Flickr, and it's still 500px, although I'm on the fence about that one moving forward based on who they're owned by and their current changes. But I have an audience that is somewhat distinct on these different platforms. I get comments from people on Flickr that don't follow me on Facebook and vice versa. And the growth is organic and slow. It happens, like almost a decade now, been trying to grow these audiences. And it's in the thousands on every platform. But it is a slow path. And I think everybody has to just walk that path. There's no shortcut.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It just delegitimizes all the hard work that people like us have done to build that audience.
Exactly. All right. Now, because again, it's a slow news week, I'm digging through all of the photo blogs and I'm finding like reviews of different things. I found this one that was pretty interesting on F-Stoppers. It was called the Microfogger, the pocket-sized smoke machine. F-Stoppers gave it a review. In any of the video work that you've done, Jordan, have you done much work with smoke or fog?
I used to. There's a story based on this that was in a Camera Store episode, but I fog everything. If I'm shooting a narrative, if I'm indoors, I love the way that it gives you an idea of the direction that the light's coming from. That's how I tend to use it. You know, if I want to emphasize that the light's coming from a window, throw a little haze in there, you get that wonderful little streak coming towards your subject. We shot an episode where we were doing Goodfellas, recreating a scene from that at a bar. And just using a hazer like we did with every other shoot. And I was unaware that a lot of places are starting to get visual smoke detectors. Have you heard about these?
No, but I think that makes sense for the control of vaping, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's just a different, because I guess it takes a little bit longer before smoke will activate a more traditional smoke alarm. But we, unfortunately, this little bar was tied into basically an entire block of buildings that used to be one building, and we evacuated an entire block while we were shooting our little short film. And I've been so wary ever since that, you know, using haze machines. I really like the aerosol atmosphere.
Yes, I've had some of that too.
It's wonderful stuff. Where this looks really, really compelling to me, because it's a fairly small amount of haze it's throwing out, just enough to add a little atmosphere to your shot or give you an idea where the lighting direction's coming from.
And it fits in it fits in your hand, right? And so, I mean, like a can of atmosphere might do this. I have a really large, bulky fog machine that I bought to do some macro photography stuff to have fog rolling over flowers and things like that, which I found to be interesting. But it was outputting way too much. There was no throttle on that. So I would turn the machine on and turn it off 10 seconds later, and the entire room is just hard to breathe in. So
yeah, and then you're spending 10 minutes or something trying to clear the space to get the level of haze that you want. I'd always much rather have something that's throwing a tiny amount of haze I can keep holding than a giant smoke cloud that then you've got to open a bunch of windows and dissipate.
Right. And having something small handheld, I can position it on top of, beside, underneath a subject on a small scale. I'm coming to this from a macro photographer. And so it looks like it is one of those things to add depth and some level of almost fantasy to the work. If I were to add a tiny bit of mist to, say, some of my ultraviolet images where things are fluorescing, then you'll see the fluorescing object cast light into the mist. And I did a test, kind of a proof of concept shot with my large fogger using invisible ink in the heart of a flower, and it just illuminated the swirls of the fog. It was really cool because I did it in 3D. And if you see it in 3D, the volume of the fog is really what gives it the magic. But I never revisited it. It was kind of a research and development budget option to buy that fogger, and now it's been sitting there because it was so hard to use. This handheld fogging unit seems like it's going to be exactly what I need to make some fun. And maybe even outside in my winter macro stuff, it could be useful to lay fog over snow, floating around freezing soap bubbles, or whatever it happens to be. There's creative ideas are kind of floating through my head when I see something like this. So I immediately, without even fully reading the article, I went to the bottom about what they liked and what they didn't like. They said what they liked: it's subtle and easy to control, can be used indoors, compact size, sufficient battery life, doesn't smell, and charges via a USB cable. And what they didn't like was it could be better outdoors. Well, it's not a tool for outdoors just by the very nature of it. And a longer release of the smoke for a more powerful effect. Well, and that's okay. I mean, that's kind of what you're getting when it has a small amount of output. It's not going to be that big fogger. So I just immediately, kind of sight unseen, didn't even really read much in the way of comments on it. It costs £80, pound sterling. So not sure what that came to Canadian. but I added in the fog liquid as well, which gave me an extra £5 cost to it. And it's in the mail. And who knows, with the Canada Post strikes that we have going on right now, I might get it by the springtime. But it will be on my doorstep, and I can give it either a yay or a nay at the time that it comes out. Interestingly enough, I was reading the comments on it, and some people were saying, you know, why don't you just use a vaping machine? Well, I mean, I don't want to be breathing that stuff in. I don't smoke. Right. And somebody said, yeah, you've got to press the power button like 5 times to turn it on or something. And that's totally what these vaping hardware machines do. And yeah, if they're basing it on that and I don't have to breathe it in, then I'm more than happy to pay for this specific device.
Yeah. Well, and that ties into what was the real appeal for me is they said it doesn't have the smell. And the one thing no reviews are touching on, I'm very curious about, is how much noise it makes. Because my big hazer, you know, as soon as I want to kick something in the background or something, it basically sounds like a leaf blower going off. And, you know, I'd love to just actually add a little puff while I'm rolling. So if this is nice and quiet and something I can just kind of accent a shot while it's going on, especially close-ups, then this could be an amazingly useful tool. And it's just not going to aggravate the talent, you know. Yeah. I know it's just vegetable oil or whatever, but nobody on set likes when you grab the fogger and just blast it straight at their faces. So if this is something that the talent's comfortable having around them, then this is awesome. I'm going to get 4 of these.
Well, and if you have like a scene, if you're sitting at a restaurant and it's set in the 1950s, you could have one just running on the table behind you, creating smoke as if the people back there are actively smoking without them having to actually be smoking, right? I mean, there's a substitute for so many different things that can really create that atmosphere, so long as it is what it says it is. And, you know, again, that's part of my R&D budget to kind of test it and see if it's going to be useful. If I can get it to make one image that I then sell a print of, then it's paid for itself. It's not an expensive item. And it's all about how, you know, photographers control their environment, or videographers as well. Before we move on from this, Jordan, you mentioned you use this a lot in your sort of production work. But
yeah, narrative work generally.
Do you have any other tips that people can use to either modify light, add atmosphere, or otherwise make the scene feel a little bit more deep?
Yeah, I think that's the real mistake that a lot of people go into. And I initially made when I was looking at some of these is, yeah, it's for a smoky hotel lounge or something like that. But watching a lot of great cinematographers work, I would just constantly see them putting a little bit of just a little dusting of haze in it. And that's something that I'm sure we could get out of this. Even like a little breath of cigarette smoke or something is often enough just to give your light direction. And when we're shooting, you know, trying to tell a story, and we're seeing more of this now in portrait photography as well, is people really like motivated light where you can see where the light is theoretically coming from. Mm-hmm. And the best way to emphasize that is, yeah, just throw a little haze in there and you'll be able to actually see the light moving from the source to your subject.
The proverbial foggy morning sunrise, that you can see the direction of the sun passing through the fog and everything. I mean, that's always been appealing for me. Now, to achieve that, you do need to have relatively directional light. You know, you can't be diffusing everything, because then the fog just becomes fog. I mean, it fades things away in the background, but you can't really see the directions of that. So how would you deal with a more directional light? It wouldn't be in all scenarios, but, you know, window light coming in would be relatively directional. You know, light from a lamp on a desk would have that same kind of directional, creating that cone, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I really like to use them because a lot of the time your hair light or your backlight is a pretty hard light source. And we're using that to add depth in a shot, generally, is its main reason for being, unless you want to really aggressively backlight your subject. So if you've got one of those and a little bit of haze, then you're really starting to add a lot of depth and people can see where your foreground is, where the quality of the light is different, and then the background where you have that extra texture to it. It's just a great way to make a shot or a scene feel really lived in.
Cool. Yeah. I'm looking forward to experimenting with this thing. Again, like that Laowa 24mm probe lens and so many other sort of edge cases in photography, that it's like a fisheye lens. I'm not going to use that probe lens for everything. But if I have that scenario, it is the best tool for that. And I'll find some creative uses for it if I've got it in my bag, or I can run down into my studio and grab it off a shelf.
Yeah. And this is, that's the other great thing here is it's going to take up no space in a bag where I've got to make a pretty conscious effort if I'm going to drag the fogger and a jug of liquid fog as well out to a shoot. I want it. So tell me if it's loud and if it stinks. Those are the two things I want to hear from
Okay. you. I will let you know whenever it arrives on my doorstep. Again, talking about photographers and sort of the attitudes of photographers, there's a story published by DP Review.
Oh, those guys are great.
They have their moments. Some Kansas City hotspots ban photography over growing disruptions. And I thought this was pretty interesting. Jordan, did you watch the video for this?
I did. And I love cable news. It's pretty good. But this is kind of, in some ways, kind of a silly argument. I can understand there's some cool looking buildings where photographers can be inconvenient. And it's funny, at the camera store, they made a point of making a really dramatic graffiti mural. I'm not sure if you saw that when you had a chance to visit the camera store in Calgary.
I did notice it. Yeah, I didn't get a close look at it, but it's attractive.
Yeah, and it's constantly, we had photographers pretty much all hours of the day out there shooting in front of it. And of course, that was the goal with the camera store. But what if you've got a little interesting, older, or grittier kind of environment that photographers are just naturally drawn to? The main news story was how this can be really inconvenient for the owners or the renters or whoever's in the area.
Well, now I'm of two sides for this, because if somebody owns it, it's their property. And you are walking onto private property without permission and doing some professional level of work. Even if you're an amateur, you are creating images on their property without their permission. Now, if somebody were to walk into my gardens without asking me to do so and start taking some pictures of my flowers, I'd go up to them and I'd ask them what the heck they're doing. If you want to photograph these flowers, I do workshops that I charge people for, and you're more than welcome to sign up for one of those. But just to say that you're inconvenienced by people being there, I think is a bit of a jerk move, but there is liability reasons. What if somebody trips and hurts themselves? Well, it was on your property, so you might be liable, especially if you didn't put up any signs stating that they couldn't be there in some very obvious way. I think the signs that they were putting up were more to be right in the shot that people were trying to take, so that it would just be a disruptive background for that. And that's very passive aggressive, I suppose. What would the solution be here? I mean, the photographers are still going to show up. Do you charge them?
Yeah.
Do you make them pay a shooting fee to take images on site?
Well, I think you can go a little less if you really don't want them there. I don't see any harm in a simple no trespassing sign that doesn't single out photographers as the source of the concern. It's pretty common. You don't want people there. Just throw one of those up where this did. I know, of course, you're going to get a news story out of it, singling out photographers for it. But if that's the problem, throw the sign up. Or like you said, there's no harm in collecting a little money if it's a site that's being used all the time.
You know, if it's a $5 fee, or if there's a box that says, hey, if you want to use this site, put in a donation. Some people will, some people won't, but you'll get something from it. So that'll ease the inconvenience, perhaps. I love the idea of putting a no trespassing sign. That makes a lot more sense than no photographers. One sign even said no basic photographers. If you're above a basic level, then we'll allow you. But if you've got a cell phone in your hand, you better find somewhere else to be.
I think they should just have their portfolios printed, at least like a 11x14 with them when they show up to confirm that they are not basic photographers. I think that's
Also to another point here, photography is often being chastised in public places, in public parks and forests and everything. And photographers are always in the news because the few bad apples among us spoil the whole thing, where they will walk into very sensitive places that, they have to deliberately go over fences or barriers that say you shouldn't go there, and they do so anyways. But I think there was also a mention in this article that the Kansas City was going to be enacting something similar in their public spaces, or at least some of their public spaces that had a very similar photographic appeal. And in that sense, I am dead against it. I mean, I would want, if I am a citizen, I should be afforded all of the rights of citizenship to take pictures. If I were sitting there in that park with an easel and some oil paints and I was trying to paint things, there's no bylaw officer that's going to show up and write me a ticket. Why should a photographer suffer any worse fate than that artist?
Well, and this is something that I certainly struggle with more than a lot of photographers, because we're out there taking pictures while also recording video so often. So this is something where we will very regularly have people ask what we're up to. And of course, if it's national parks, anything like that, it's completely illegal without a permit. But in public spaces, yeah, we do see a lot of blowback. I mean, you know, just shooting underneath a bridge one day, we had someone who refused to leave because they were convinced that we were going to do something horrible with our footage of the bridge, despite Chris talking about, you know, frame per second and the megapixel count on that camera while we were there. It's something that it's just a perception issue. And it is, unfortunately, I think, getting worse. You know, there's that cliche of the creepy photographer, and it's not going away, and it makes people uncomfortable. And it's tough for us who are legitimately professionals.
Yeah, I'm lucky that a lot of my stuff is literally photographed in my backyard, 2 feet from my back door this time of the year specifically. But if I were to be out in public, you know, I remember photographing down by my city's waterfront. There were some tiny little red beetles, not even sure what they were, but they were kind of moving around and I was following them around visually, just seeing until they did something interesting. And one climbed into a dandelion and started eating the pollen. But here I am lying on my belly with a monstrosity of a camera in front of me. Along one of the walking paths down by my waterfront. And I'm there for 15, 20 minutes, firing off rapid fire bursts, probably hundreds of photographs of what any passerby sees as a dandelion. No one approached me. I don't even think they made eye contact because what the heck is this guy doing that he can't be doing in his backyard? Well, it was those tiny little beetles that I was after. And my waterfront is public space. I can do whatever I want there that's legal to do anywhere. And you know, photography included. So I've put up a fuss about things like this in the past. And, you know, we mentioned in a previous episode, I was told not to use my camera on the TTC, the Toronto Transit Commission, on a subway. And I didn't want to get into a fight, even though I knew my rights. I had looked them up previously. I just packed it up because it wasn't worth ruining my day over. But if I was legitimately just taking pictures, you know, with, like, imagine that same waterfront is where my wife and I got married. And we were out there taking our wedding photos. Some of those iconic spots, if photographers kept falling into the water and suing the city and they said no photos allowed here, well, that's not exactly the proper solution to that end.
Well, and I really liked in that same conversation where you're saying, like, it's a great idea to just have even your rights written out so you've got those. But a lot of the time I just weigh it in terms of how important, like, do I feel like I'm on the brink of something? Like, A, that I need to finish a video, or, you know, a shot that I'm going to be very proud of down the road. And most of the time, it's just not worth the fuss. But in those situations where it's not, I think that's a great idea to just in your camera bag have, you know, just some of the laws in whatever country you're in, just so that you can show people and have something to back up your argument. Because I don't just want someone there convinced that I'm about to blow up a bridge.
And you just dropped a hint that you actually listen to this podcast. So thank you very much.
That's great. That's why I'm happy to be here.
All right. Again, it was a slow news week and we stretched out the news for about 43 minutes at this point.
I'm pretty proud of us for that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's dive into our picks of the week because I think that there's some interesting things to discuss here. My pick is one that I was actively using yesterday that had just arrived to me. KNF Concepts is a company that makes a lot of interesting and useful inexpensive tools for photographers. One of the hosts, I think, mentioned their entire catalog of stuff as a pick previously. And I've got some of their lens mount adapters and what have you, and been very happy with it. But I had the idea to start coloring lights for specific projects to instead of just putting a gel in front of a light that will have a minimal effect on the color, color temperature of the light. What if you want it to be drastic? You want like a harsh blue light or a green or a red or any color? Well, they make this kit that has like any primary saturated color that you could really want of 52 millimeter filters. I forget exactly how many there are in this kit. If I pull it up, it doesn't say. The list is just, it goes on and on and on.
Yeah.
So I guess 27 filters.
Perfect.
So 27 filters. Some of them are solid color. Some of them are white, and they grade. They have a gradient to a specific solid color as well.
That's what's jumping out to me right now. You could do some really interesting stuff with that.
Well, and especially if you wanted to, and I was thinking about doing this the other day, is to have like two or three of the graduated color filters kind of stacked together to create kind of a very specific kind of rainbow effect, or maybe just a yellow on the bottom and a blue on the top, and then put that in front of your light source and have the light kind of fade from one color to another across the scene. Again, coming from a macro photographer's perspective, controlling the lighting using smaller flashlights is a really easy thing to do. And these at 52 millimeters will fit over most flashlights. Just a little bit of gaffer's tape, because the flashlights don't have filter threads. But $57.99 US for this very complete set of experimental filters. I don't know if I'd ever put them on my camera per se.
Right.
I might do some experiments with that. They do have a red, a blue, and a green, and I can approximate the primary sensor colors and maybe do some tests and experiments with that. But for less than $60, 27 filters of variety of different colors that, I'm sure their optical quality is not up to par to something like a breakthrough filter. They have one that they call gray rather than calling it a neutral density filter, because I think calling it an ND filter would be a stretch.
Right.
At this price point, I figured, hey, why not?
Yeah. Well, and I have a little Hono pack of, they call it their creative filters. And I think that was $50, and they're just strips of gel for an on-camera flash, where the filter idea is interesting because it's kind of a double use. What I think I'm kind of surprised by when this came up, I was thinking, with all these LEDs now that aren't throwing much heat, wouldn't it be great if somebody made a light with a camera filter thread on it? Just a little single point LED.
What's that new Pro Light? Was it from Photix or somebody else? I can't remember. That has a circular flash head.
Yeah, that we're starting.
There's
to see
no
more
reason
of
why you can't put circular, filter threads on that.
Yeah, I'd even love to see an adapter. You could just like a snoot with a filter thread on the front of it would be wonderful. Mm-hmm. This is my suggestion to all the lighting and flash manufacturers right now. Let's make this happen.
All of them that are listening, yes. Yeah. but it does issue a certain sense of creativity. When you have this as a tool, you might think of a way to use it. Now, it's not right for every scenario. When I was shooting freezing soap bubbles last night, I made a very orange freezing soap bubble by putting the orange filter in front of the light and putting the blue one in front of a secondary light illuminating the foreground. I alluded to the photograph earlier. I'll put it in the show notes as well for people to see what was created with it. Mm-hmm. But that level of creativity, maybe I could have gone out and bought some of the cheap colored cellophane stuff from the dollar store and had some semi-passable results, but it wouldn't have been nearly as saturated or as easy to do.
Well, and it would just be a hell of a lot more expensive. You're looking Canadian. I think it's like $8.50 for a sheet of gel. And I have a bunch of those for the filters that I use a lot, reds or color correction and stuff. But if you've got a big bag of 27 filters for $60, then that's just a lot of room to play for not much investment.
Yeah. So anybody that's curious about that wants to creatively control the color of their light, then this is what I would recommend you buy. Okay, Jordan, your pick is something that we are both familiar with.
Yeah, it was really nice when you were out and we were shooting the macro video. I think that was a month ago now. I had a pre-production Atomos Ninja 5, and now it's production and it's shipping to people. And I think it's a really kind of breakthrough product for its price point and size. So for your audiences, I know there's a lot of photographers out there who might not be familiar with, they've certainly seen these, but might not know what they're for. An external recorder is going to do a few things for you. It's going to give you a big, beautiful screen that makes it a lot easier to focus and expose.
Gets 5 inches on this one, right?
Yeah, this is 5.5, I believe, on this guy. Full 1080 display, but extremely bright. And that's one of the big benefits. This is a 1000 nit monitor, which is certainly something that in direct sunlight you can still make out, as opposed to the back screen on your camera's LCD. And when something is really precise, like I could certainly see this being useful for you, you can't get your eye up to the viewfinder and you're having difficulty making out that little LCD screen. That alone is probably worth the investment for a lot of people. And this is priced comparably to a lot of similar monitors.
I looked it up on B&H. It is $695 US.
Yeah, now bear in mind with these, you do have to grab a few accessories to take full advantage of them. You got to get Sony L batteries, which most filmmakers will have, but a lot of photographers might not. You got to grab some cables. You need to get some hard drives if you want to record off of this.
But now, does it have its own internal storage?
It doesn't. No, you do just use regular SSDs for this. Okay. So you can grab, yeah, just a cheap laptop hard drive, or it's really nice. A company called Angel Bird, I'll double check that, are making form fitted SSDs that'll fit really snugly right on the device. You don't have to use a caddy for it.
Oh, cool. But again, when we were using this in the field, there was a very legitimate purpose for it. We wanted incredibly high quality video output that was useful for showing not just the video, but the camera user interface overlay, which is also pumped out via HDMI if you choose to, so that it can show you what you would see exactly on the back of the LCD screen for the instructional purposes that we had. Of course, you can turn those features off. And it has the ability to record, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, to a higher quality than recording internal to the camera would be in some cases, right?
Yeah, it depends on the camera you're hooking in, but we've seen a lot of the new crop of mirrorless cameras. You're seeing huge benefits for that, especially the Nikon Z6, which I am actually testing right now. It's sitting in front of me. And the Z7, those are going to get you 10 bits, which is a dramatic difference if you're planning to really work with those files afterwards. The Canon EOS R as well is going to output 10 bit to this. Now, I didn't find as much of an advantage with that camera with its 10 bit output. I just don't know if it's the format they're using or the sensor or whatever. But still, this came out at the absolute perfect time where we're seeing some exciting cameras where you will get a big improvement in the quality. And this is certainly, you know, before we'd be looking at about 1800 Canadian to get access to 4K 60. Now we're looking at, like you were saying, 695 on B&H.
Right. And, you know, if you want to get it with a 500 gigabyte SSD, you know, you're at $1,000. If you want to get that just all as a kit together without having to fuss about anything else, which also comes with the battery, two batteries and a charger. So the expense is there. Yeah. Now, there's no question about it, but you get what you pay for. I'm sure there are cheaper alternatives out there, but when you're trusting your data to an external recorder, you don't only want it to be bright and easy to use. You want it to be as good as it can possibly be. And from what I understand, you're giving it that as a recommendation.
Yeah, exactly. And honestly, you said, like, I'm sure there's some cheaper options, but for something that records 4K 60, I actually am not aware of one right now. So very inexpensive, but the entire thing feels very well built. The interface is very well thought out. And Atomos is one of those wonderful companies like Fuji, where you're seeing not just bug fixes in firmware, but major feature upgrades all the time. Support for new camera log files. I know they've got some coming for Nikon's N-Log, and we're going to see something for the C-Log on the EOS R that's slightly different from what we see with Canon cinema cameras. All of that is on the way, but I'm sure we'll see some major updates as well. I just think Atomos is a really great company, and this is a big step forward for them.
I want to confirm that Angel Bird is the name associated with the SSDs form fitting to this.
Yeah, and they're great. Having that little SSD sitting off the side, I just found it's very easy to bump it. And the last thing I want to do is actually damage the connections on an SSD drive. So having it sit flush with the monitor is a big benefit. For your audience too, and you touched on it, but having your entire camera's overlay that you can record externally, if they're the kind of people who want to get into doing online tutorials or anything like that, this is the best method for doing that I've seen, where you can see every change happening in real time with the exposure simulation that we've got on mirrorless cameras now as well. I think it's just a great learning tool. And I can say that it's made the DP Review TV channel just a lot more professional looking. And I'm falling back on this technique all the time now, where before it was a big hassle for me to drag out a giant external recorder. This is something small. I just leave it in the bag. Chris does something interesting. I can flop it on the top. It's awesome.
And I will say, though, it is bigger than my Lumix GX9 was. So when we mounted that on the top of it, it was really top heavy and a little bit tricky to handle. I mean, it is a 5 or 5.5 inch display with a bit of a frame around that and a certain amount of thickness. There's a lot inside of this device. So if you have a really small camera, It makes it, I don't want to say less usable, but a bit clunky. But if you have like a full frame camera of any size, it's the perfect size match for that.
Yeah, exactly. I've seen some people on YouTube who are using it with Sony RX100 cameras,
really?
The little pocket cams, because then now you get your selfie screen on it and you get better external recording and a mic jack and a headphone jack with this.
And it's three times the size of your camera.
it's lunacy. I don't get it. But I don't know. I guess they're getting good results out of it.
Yeah. Hey, well, okay. You look at people say, oh, this was shot on iPhone. And yes, technically it was. But if you see the mounting rig and all of the additional hardware attached to it around it,
yeah.
It is 45 times the size of the phone by volume and weight. And yes, the core of that is the iPhone. Sure, you can say you shot this on your RX100. You are correct.
Well, we're talking about it, so it was clearly a smart decision.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay, Jordan, as we wind down the episode, where can people find the content that you create and follow you online?
Well, the biggest one is youtube.com/DP Review. And we've got our own playlist there for all the stuff that we put out for DP Review TV. They put some other camera tests out on there, and there's the odd bit of sponsored content. But if it says DP Review TV on it, you know that's something that I'm shooting and Chris is hosting generally. As well, people can track me down on Instagram. I'm that Jordan Drake. And on Twitter, I'm also that Jordan Drake.
Very Sorry. Easy to remember that then. And those links I'll put in the show notes and any others that you can think up after the fact. And those show notes you can find at photogeekweekly.com. I do want to thank the people that have taken a little bit of extra time out of their day and written a positive review on iTunes. I've seen a few new ones show up. And I think because of that, the audience is continuing to grow for this this podcast. So thank you from the bottom of my heart for doing that. It does mean a lot, because as that audience grows, so too does the opportunities and the interest and the feedback and people submitting new stories and the occasional people putting money in the tip jar. Thank you extra for that, because that is just about now covering the hosting costs for the podcast. So,
we're there.
Onward and upward. And you can find all of that at photogeekweekly.com. It's time to get out and shoot.